From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Many of the buildings, houses, has been completely destroyed. More than 90% of the buildings have been destroyed. People are still haven't gone through yet. They still got awareness, but it will take time. It will take time before they can cliff up.
About half the population of the South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu has been left homeless after it was hit by Cyclone Pam, a Category 5 storm. Vanuatu's president directly linked the storm to climate change. We'll get an update from 350.org's Bill McKibben. He'll also talk about how a NASA scientist estimates California has about 1 year of water left, and how the United Nations body responsible for global climate change negotiations is backing the campaign to persuade investors to sell off their fossil fuel assets. Then, as WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marks his 1,000th day seeking asylum in Ecuador's London embassy, Swedish prosecutors have agreed for the first time to come to London to question him.
We see this as a victory for Assange. We see this as an evidence that we were right all the time, that the prosecutor was wrong all the time, and we welcome her initiative, and we will cooperate fully to get this interrogation made as soon as possible. But it may take some time, but that will not be up to us.
We'll get an update from WikiLeaks and from Assange's lawyer, Michael Ratner. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A devastating cyclone in the South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu has left half the population homeless and an unknown number dead. A Category 5 storm, Cyclone Pam, flattened buildings and washed away roads and bridges. Speaking during a visit to Japan just as the storm hit, Vanuatu President Baldwin Lonsdale appealed for international aid.
I stand to appeal on behalf of the government and people of Vanuatu to the global community to give a lending hand in responding to these very current calamities that have been struck us. Fellow heads of state, governments, and development partners, we have all experienced our form of disaster at one time or another. Today, we appeal for your assistance.
President Lonsdale said climate change is contributing to the disaster, with global warming fueling extreme weather and stronger cyclones. We'll speak with 350.org founder Bill McKibben after headlines. Activists in the Syrian town of Dumas say more than 30 people have been killed in the government buildings of residential areas and schools. Children were reportedly among the dead. The attack comes as the Syrian conflict has entered its fifth year. The UN Refugee Agency calls it the biggest humanitarian emergency of our era, with at least 220,000 people killed and 4 million displaced. Daniel Gorvin of the British charity Oxfam said 2014 was the worst year in the Syrian civil war to date.
The Security Council resolutions have been largely ignored by the parties to the conflict. In fact, if you look across the indicators which we've analysed, there's been more killings, more bombings, a massive increase in displacement, and a huge increase in the number of people that are in need of humanitarian assistance inside Syria.
As the Syria conflict marks its fourth anniversary, the Obama administration's publicly backed talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Obama administration's quietly stopped calling for Assad's ouster with the rise of the self-proclaimed Islamic State across large parts of Syria and neighboring Iraq. Speaking to CBS News, Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. and allies are mulling options to bring Assad back to the table.
There is no military solution. There is only a political solution. But to get the Assad regime to negotiate, we're going to have to make it clear to him that there is a determination by everybody to seek that political outcome and change his calculation about negotiating. That's underway right now. And I am convinced that with the efforts of our allies and others, there will be increased pressure on Assad.
And you'd be willing to negotiate with him?
Well, we have to negotiate in the end.
Iran has resumed talks with the United States and five other world powers in Switzerland ahead of this month's deadline for a framework nuclear deal. The New York Times reports negotiators are confronting last-minute obstacles over the timeline for easing the sanctions on Iran and the intensity of international inspections. Iran wants an immediate end to all United Nations sanctions and has rejected U.S. demands for inspections of any potential nuclear site, including Iranian military bases. Ahead of the new talks, Secretary of State John Kerry was mum about the deal's chances.
As you all know, we have set the end of the month as the deadline. And so we will be going into this understanding that time is critical. I can't tell you whether or not we can get a deal or whether we're close.
The talks resume on the eve of national elections in Israel, where the leading opponent of negotiations with Iran, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is in a tight race for re-election. Some polls show Netanyahu's Likud trailing the Zionist Union coalition led by Justice Minister Tzipi Livni and Finance Minister Yair Lapid. The joint list, a coalition of four Arab parties, is running in third place and could be decisive in forming a new coalition that would unseat Netanyahu. In recent campaign speeches, Netanyahu has suggested he would never withdraw from the occupied territories or allow a Palestinian state there. His foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, recently made headlines after calling for the beheading of disloyal Arab-Israeli citizens, prompting critics to label him the Jewish ISIS. More than a million people rallied across Brazil on Sunday in a protest against the government of President Dilma Rousseff. Organizers called the day of action to oppose a sluggish economy and a corruption scandal at the state-run energy company Petrobras. According to Reuters, many protesters come from the country's wealthier classes, traditional foes of Rousseff's working party. Rousseff was narrowly reelected to a second term in October. Venezuelan lawmakers have given final approval to a new decree powers for President Nicolas Maduro. The measure enables Maduro to make laws on his own for up to 6 months. Maduro says the authority is necessary following the Obama administration's designation of Venezuela as a national security threat. A number of South American governments have denounced the U.S. move ahead of a regional summit in Panama next month. On Friday, Bolivian President Evo Morales called on President Obama to issue a public apology.
I very much regret the attitude of U.S. President Barack Obama. He throws a threat, an aggressive planning of military intervention in Venezuela. Could it be that Obama is afraid of democracies in Latin America and the Caribbean? Could it be that Barack Obama is the enemy of political and economic sovereignty of countries in Latin America?
An immigration appeals court has upheld the deportation order of a former El Salvador general accused of murder and torture. Carlos Eugenio Vides Casanova is wanted in El Salvador for his role in the notorious killings of four U.S. churchwomen in 1980. A 2012 decision marked the first time an immigration judge ordered a top-ranking foreign military leader deported under a 2004 law intended to bar human rights violators from U.S. soil. General Vides was a close U.S. government ally during his stint as defense minister for the Salvadoran junta between 1983 and 89. The churchwomen's families have fought for years to hold him and other U.S.-backed Salvadoran officials responsible for the deaths. In a ruling last week, the Board of Immigration Appeals found there's ample evidence General Vides was complicit in the Americans' rape and murder, as well as the torture of political prisoners. Vides, who lives in Florida, can still appeal in federal court. A suspect has been arrested in last week's shooting of two police officers in Ferguson, Missouri. The attack occurred outside the Ferguson police headquarters as protesters marked the ouster of Police Chief Tom Jackson following months of activism. The suspect has been identified as 20-year-old Jeffrey Williams, St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough, said he may not have deliberately targeted police, but instead someone in the crowd with whom he had a dispute.
Essentially, what we've charged him with is firing shots. It's possible at this point that he was firing shots at someone other than the police, but struck the police officer. So the charge is still assault in the first degree. They're Class A felonies for striking those two officers. There was a weapon recovered, which has been tied to the shell casings that were recovered there, a weapon recovered from him. And he has acknowledged his participation in firing the shots, or that in fact he did fire the shots that struck the two officers.
The suspect, Jeffrey Williams, was identified with public help. Prosecutor McCullough described him as a protester, but several Ferguson activists say he did not take part in the demonstrations. Hundreds of people have gathered in Madison, Wisconsin, for the funeral of Tony Robinson, an unarmed black teenager shot dead by police. Police say Robinson was fatally shot after an officer responded to a report of a man jumping in and out of traffic and assaulting someone. His killing has sparked protests in the latest display of the Black Lives Matter movement. In a packed high school field house hosting the funeral, a friend of Tony Robinson broke down as he paid tribute.
And as his aunt Lolo said, he began to talk about how he would live forever and how he would be something great. I can't.
Sorry, we did. Sorry. Yes, sir.
I'll finish it for you.
Dozens of people have completed a multi-day reenactment of the historic Selma to Montgomery marches of 1965. On March 7, 1965, hundreds of peaceful voting rights activists were attacked by Alabama state troopers as they tried to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge, attempting to march from Selma to Montgomery. Bloody Sunday was the first of three attempted marches, finally completed under federal protection and led by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. on March 24th. Democratic Congressmember Terry Sewell of Alabama was among those taking part in the anniversary event.
I think it's so important to remember that this is not just one event in history, that this is really a movement for strengthening the Voting Rights Act, as well as remembering and preserving our past. You know, 50 years have passed, but there's still a renewed assault on voting rights.
Congressmember Terry Sewell is the first African-American woman to be elected to Congress from Alabama. You can see all of our coverage of the Bloody Sunday commemoration when Democracy Now! Went to Selma at democracynow.org. Robert Durst, the estranged son of one of New York's most prominent real estate families, has been arrested on murder charges over the killing of a longtime friend in 2000. Durst has been suspected in multiple killings for years. Authorities are still investigating him over the disappearance of his wife in 1982. In a separate case in 2001, Durst was acquitted of killing and dismembering an elderly neighbor after claiming the death was an accident. Durst's arrest for the murder of his friend Susan Berman came after the filming and the airing of an HBO documentary series about his life. During an unguarded moment caught on tape as Durst wore his microphone in the bathroom, he whispered, quote, "What the hell did I do? Kill them all, of course," he said. And protesters from New York City traveled to Greenwich, Connecticut Saturday to rally outside the home of billionaire hedge fund manager Paul Tudor Jones. The protests came as part of a project called Hedge Clippers, which seeks to highlight the role of hedge fund leaders in steering New York State toward policies that favor the rich. The group recently reported hedge fund managers have flooded New York State with nearly $40 million in political contributions since 2000. The largest individual beneficiary has been Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's received nearly $5 million, much of it from founders and backers of charter schools. Activists Jonathan Weston and Zakai Ansari describe their reasons for targeting Paul Tudor Jones, who has a net worth of over $4 billion.
The greedy few,
cannot control.
New York State.
Government.
And our governor.
Andrew Cuomo.
These hedge
hedge fund buddies have bought our state majority, which is Republican right now, and they're pushing policies and don't want to pass laws that help folks who don't have as much money as them. They don't, they're not thinking about passing a DREAM Act. They don't think about passing a living wage, ensuring that there's a living wage available for others. So not even those that could be as wealthy as them, so they can live.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. About half the population of the South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu has been left homeless by a devastating cyclone that struck on Friday, flattening buildings, washing away roads and bridges. Cyclone Pam was a Category 5 storm comparable in strength to Typhoon Haiyan, which hit the Philippines 2 years ago and killed more than 6,000 people. Now, aid agencies say as many as 8 people were killed during Cyclone Pam, and the death toll is expected to rise as rescuers reach more far-flung areas. Vanuatu has a population of about 250,000 people and is made up of more than 80 islands. During the storm, Vanuatu's President Baldwin Lonsdale was in Japan attending a UN conference on disaster reduction. Speaking Monday before he left to return home, he said the cyclone seasons his nation had experienced are directly linked to climate change and described the extent of the damage.
Many of the buildings, houses, has been completely destroyed. More than 90% of the buildings have been destroyed. People are still haven't gone through yet. They still got awareness, have emotional feelings, but it will take time. It will take time before they can live up. What is happening now is that, as I've said over and over again, that the people of the Republic of Vanuatu, they need humanitarian assistance at the moment. And I'm very pleased with the international communities that they have responded to my appeal, which is going through to Vanuatu right now.
Disaster relief officials and relief workers are still trying to establish contact with Vanuatu's remote islands that bore the brunt of Cyclone Pam's winds of more than 185 miles per hour. This is the president of Vanuatu's Red Cross, Hannington Alatoa. When he describes the number of people estimated displaced, he means 130,000 people, not 130.
It is unknown to the extent of the number of people affected in the other parts of the country, outside Port Vila. Agencies are estimating that approximately 130 people, that is more than half the population of the country, may have been affected by Cyclone Pam. I think that there would be a lot more when the assessment is done and the investigation is completed. Because, as I said earlier, the whole country was flattened.
Cyclone Pam also caused major damage on other Pacific islands, including Kiribati and the Solomon Islands. UNICEF says the number of children who've been displaced or affected by the cyclone may be as high as 60,000. For more, we go directly to the former head of Oxfam in Vanuatu, Alex Matheson, who is joining us from Australia. Can you talk, Alex, about what has happened in Vanuatu? And for people who have never heard of this Pacific island nation, talk about where it is.
Okay, so Vanuatu is a country made up of out of 80 islands, 65 of which are inhabited. It's in the South Pacific Ocean. It's probably about 3 hours flying time directly east of the east coast of Australia. So it's a very remote place. The capital, Port Vila, has a population of around 45 to 50,000 people. So the total population is about 260,000, then spread out over those outer islands. It's a small country with spread out over a large space, and it has major sort of logistical issues at the best of times in terms of trying to get people and supplies out to those islands. So obviously, with this massive cyclone, those logistical challenges are massive now in terms of trying to organise getting the relief and supplies to the people outside of Port Vila. In Port Vila, I mean, obviously Port Vila has been badly affected. Communications are up to Port Vila, so we were able to see what is going on there. And we're seeing sort of 80 to 90% of buildings damaged. And in the sort of poorer shanty town areas of Port Vila, we're seeing massive destruction to homes. And we're seeing significant damage to other infrastructure, such as roads being washed away by the high seas and bridges being destroyed by high rivers and as a result of flooding.
Is this the worst climate catastrophe to ever hit Vanuatu?
Certainly in living memory, there was a large cyclone in 1987 that did cause significant damage to Port Vila, but my understanding that this damage and this event far exceeds that. Vanuatu is a very disaster-prone country. The UN has it at the top of the list in terms of the most the country that's prone to most natural disasters. So in my time there, I was there for 4 years. I experienced many very large earthquakes, tsunami warnings, and a couple of cyclones, but nothing at this scale.
And how has Vanuatu prepared for something like this? When you were Oxfam director in Vanuatu, you worked with them on disaster preparations.
Sure. Yeah, so there's been a big investment in the past 4 years. So at NASA by government and also by the non-government agencies as well. So we formed a group called the Vanuatu Humanitarian Team, which is a coordination body for those non-government agencies in order to improve the way that the country is able to plan for and respond to disasters. And there's certainly been a radical change and improvement in the country during that time. And a lot of investment in that disaster management capacity at a national level. And also NGOs such as Oxfam and others have been working and supporting the disaster preparedness action at a community level as well. And we are seeing the benefits of that now during this cyclone event, the speed in which the system kicked into action within, you know, a matter of hours of the cyclone. Meetings were being held, plans were being made in terms of water and sanitation, food, logistics. So, you know, this is definitely, that investment in preparedness is definitely paying off now. That said, this disaster is so massive, it's going to stretch the capacity of any system. And the international assistance that now is coming in is very needed and very welcomed by the Vanuatu government, it seems, and also the Vanuatu people. And that assistance needs to continue in order to support the Vanuatu people with this recovery.
On Sunday, Australia announced a support package for Vanuatu, where you are now, Alex, in Australia. This is Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop.
Today, I can announce that Australia will be making an initial life-saving support package available to Vanuatu in response to a request from the government. This package will include $5 million that will be provided to Australian NGOs, particularly the Red Cross and to other United Nations partners. We will also be deploying humanitarian supplies to provide support for up to 5,000 people in the form of water, sanitation and shelter.
That's Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop. What are the figures you have now for casualties, for people displaced, Alex, for the, what is it, 90% of all of the buildings have been flattened?
I think 90% have been damaged in Port Vila. Not all of those have been flattened, so the buildings that have concrete structures are still standing, but most of those have had their roofs ripped off. So I think still in terms of actually what I'm seeing in terms of formal figures for casualties, it's still sitting at 8, but that's people in central Port Vila. I still think that the figures haven't flown through from elsewhere. And obviously we're not yet getting the information from those outer islands where we can just imagine that the situation is going to be grave. There has been some initial assessments to Tanna Island, which is the major island in the south that was directly hit, and some aerial surveillance work there. And that is painting quite a grim picture in terms of the devastation to the housing and to the infrastructure, and anecdotal reports of people saying that they're lacking, you know, food and health facilities and those sorts of things. So it seems that we're now beginning to get some access down to those areas, and imagine that the figures in terms of casualties and sort of displaced will rise as we get a clearer picture there.
Alex Matheson, we want to thank you for joining us, former Oxfam Vanuatu country director now in Australia. When we come back, we'll be joined by 350.org founder Bill McKibben. Stay with us. Music and sounds from the 350 Vanuatu Warriors. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vanuatu President Baldwin Lonsdale spoke Monday about plans to rebuild after Cyclone Pam.
We have to be very careful how we build our houses, all in the infrastructure, how we build our infrastructure in place. We must have taken into account this disaster that has happened to us, so that we can build better infrastructure, better place for development in Vanuatu.
Bill McKibben is joining us now, co-founder of 350.org, author of a number of books, including Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill, we want to talk about a number of issues here, but can you start off by talking about what's happened in Vanuatu? 350.org is active there. And how it links to climate change.
Sure. We've been hearing sporadically from our coordinator in Vanuatu, Iso Nime, who's been doing a lot of relief work as this crisis has unfolded. The picture is, as you've been saying all morning, extraordinarily grim. But Port Vila, the capital city and the place with most of the infrastructure, took a huge hit. But the winds were higher, the seas were higher, and the infrastructure much flimsier to begin with on many of the outlying islands. So the picture, I'm afraid, is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. The tragedy, you know, the bottom line tragedy here, as in so many other places around the world, is that Vanuatu's development has been put back decades with those destruction of roads, bridges, hospitals, schools. This is what's happening now around the world as people begin to kind of run on a tilted treadmill trying to develop on a disintegrating planet. And the people in Vanuatu know exactly what the culprit is. You know, in one of the most beautiful demonstrations of the climate change era last summer, Vanuatu and 10 other Pacific islands, the Pacific Warriors, 350s Pacific Warriors, built indigenous traditional canoes and took them off to Newcastle in Australia, the largest coal port in the world, and used them to blockade the great coal ships in an effort to demonstrate exactly what Cyclone Pam also demonstrated, the incredible vulnerability of so many of the poorest people in the world to the rising temperatures that we're inflicting on our one Earth.
Can you talk in a broader way about the threats that small island nations face? And then we're going to take this home, not to a small island nation, but to California, to talk about the issue not of too much water, but of too little.
Sure. Look, if you're low to the water on an island nation and the sea level starts going up, that makes everything that happens, every cyclone that comes, that much more dangerous. Even without a cyclone in the Pacific earlier this month, the huge king tides in Kiribati flooded many, many homes and villages. Add to that things like the ongoing heating and acidification of the ocean's waters and the concomitant erosion of coral reefs around the world. In many of these nations, coral reefs provide the best defense against a raging ocean, and that defense is breaking down everywhere. Add to that the fact that we keep seeing these super typhoons, super cyclones. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. It allows in arid areas for more evaporation and hence more drought. We'll talk about California in a second. But once that water's up in the air, it's going to come down someplace. And so we see from Boston, which just set yesterday the all-time record for snowfall, to places that are getting hammered by big storms, we're seeing more and more and more devastating downpour. This is a worldwide problem, but of course, places like Vanuatu are at the very sharpest end of the stick because they are so, so vulnerable.
I want to ask you about another climate crisis closer to home. On Thursday, a NASA scientist wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times headlined, "California has about 1 year of water left. Will you ration now?" Jay Famiglietti, who authored the piece, is the senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Caltech, and a professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. He wrote, quote, "The simple fact is that California is running out of water, and the problem started before our current drought. NASA data reveal total water storage in California has been in steady decline since at least 2002, when satellite-based monitoring began, although groundwater depletion has been going on since the early 20th century. Right now, the state is only about 1 year of water supply left in its reservoirs, and our strategic backup supply, groundwater, is rapidly disappearing," he wrote. Bill McKibben.
Hey, it's up and down the west coast of the United States. Yesterday, Washington State declared drought emergency over large regions. The snowpack in the Olympic Mountains is about 8% of normal. The snowpack up in the Sierra Nevada, which has to water pretty much all of California, is 20 or 25% of normal. We're in the fourth year of a drought, and the scientific papers published in the last couple of weeks said that California can really start expecting in our new climate regime that drought will be the new normal. Last year, the satellites indicated that California had lost about 63 trillion gallons of groundwater to evaporation. That took so much weight off the crust there that the Sierra Nevada mountains jumped a half inch. There's no way that you can have civilizations of the kind that we've built in California without water. And there's less and less of it all the time. It's not just California. Go south to São Paulo, the fifth or sixth largest city in the world. People are there in a drought so desperate for water that they've begun to try and drill through the concrete in their basements looking for groundwater. There have been parts of the city that have been undergoing severe water rationing. This is what happens when you raise the temperature of the earth. There's no huge surprise in it. But it is horrifying to see it play out.
As we speak, Oxford University in Britain is set to vote on a measure to divest from coal. The decision could come during our show. Meanwhile, the UN body responsible for global climate change negotiations is backing the fast-growing campaign persuading investors to sell off their fossil fuel assets. Nick Nuttall, the spokesperson for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, said, quote, "We support divestment as it sends a signal to companies, especially coal companies, that the age of burn what you like, when you like, cannot continue. Well, at the UN climate talks in Peru in December, Democracy Now! Senior producer Mike Burke asked UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon about the movement to divest from fossil fuels.
Mike Burke from Democracy Now! In New York. Over the past year, many churches, investment funds and schools have joined a movement to divest from fossil fuel companies. And I'm wondering if you support this movement.
It's encouraging these days that there is a greater awareness and the willingness that they are now investing their resources into more sustainable energy. Of course, you know, practically speaking, in our real world, this fossil fuel may have to continue to be used as our energy sources.
That was the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Again, the UN body responsible for global climate change negotiations has just announced it's backing this fast-growing campaign persuading investors to sell off their fossil fuel assets. Bill McKibben, how significant is this? Is it a real shift?
You know, I remain slightly in shock about the whole thing. 3 years ago, it was a few of us. You know, I wrote the first big piece about this for Rolling Stone magazine. At this point, this idea, this divestment idea, now encompasses great universities from Stanford to Sydney to Stockholm. It encompasses religious denominations, United Church of Christ, the World Council of Churches. There are cities like Oslo and Seattle. The Rockefeller family, the first family of fossil fuel. Today, Oxford's taking a vote. In a couple of weeks, people are descending on Harvard. You know, all kinds of people. Al Gore, yes, but also a two-time Reagan appointee to the SEC. Also Desmond Tutu, all Harvard alumni of one kind or another, demanding that the university sell its shares. So this has become one of the many faces of the fossil fuel movement, the fossil fuel resistance. And it's very much hand in hand with those Vanuatuans standing up to the biggest coal mines in the world in Australia. Those coal mines can't be developed without the kind of financial lifeline that we're trying to cut off when we do things like divestment. So it's, you know, though the news is very bad from the physical world, from what's going on in the surf and in the atmosphere and in our drying reservoirs, at least the fight is fully underway. There's a strong resistance being mounted at every level, and the fact that the UN itself has now said we should be divesting from fossil fuel is just an indication of how powerfully people have organized around the globe.
George Monbiot just tweeted, "I've pledged to hand back my degree if Oxford University does not divest from fossil fuels. Please make the right decision." Also, Harvard University, again, the divestment movement is launching the first week of April, continuing to push for it there.
Yes, George Monbiot is going to hand back his Oxford degree, and almost as powerfully, Natalie Portman has demanded that Harvard divest. So it's everywhere now, Amy.
Speaking of small island nations, I want to ask you what happened to the former president of the Maldives. A documentary was made based on his life, the island president. Environmentalist and former Maldives president Mohamed Nasheed has been sentenced to 13 years in prison after he was found guilty of ordering the arrest of a judge while in office. The judge was appointed by his predecessor, Mahmoud Abdul Gayoom, who ruled the Maldives for 30 years before Nasheed became its first democratically elected president in 2008. Nasheed became famous in 2009 for holding a cabinet meeting underwater to show the threat of climate change to his island nation. We spoke to the former president in 2012 when that film on his rise to power and climate activism was released in New York. Again, that film called Island President was directed by John Schenck. This is an excerpt.
If we can't stop the sea is rising. If you allow for a 2-degree rise in temperature, you are actually agreeing to kill us.
I'm
I have an objective, which is to save a nation. I know it's a huge task. I've been arrested 12 times. I've been tortured twice. I spent 18 months in solitary.
We won our battle for democracy in the Maldives. A year later, there are those who tell us that solving climate change is impossible. Well, I am here to tell you that we refuse to give up hope.
That's an excerpt from John Shanks, the island president. Well, the former President Nasheed reiterated the urgency of the climate crisis for small island states when we spoke to him on Democracy Now.
Change is a real issue, and it is happening now. It's not something in the future. If you, from John's film, you would be able to see how precarious and how vulnerable the Maldives is. Any imbalance to nature will have very, very huge impacts on the low-lying Maldive Islands. And not just simply the Maldive Islands, but also all coastal regions around the world. I think about a third of the population of the world lives on coastal areas, and they will be seriously challenged if we are unable to do something about climate change in the next few years.
So that is the former president, Mohamed Nasheed, who has now been sentenced to 13 years in prison. Bill McKibben, do you know about this case?
Yeah, no, I've been to the Maldives a number of times, and I know Nasheed reasonably well. He's not only a great climate hero, first among world leaders to really be willing to take a dramatic stand. He's also the Mandela of the Indian Ocean. He spent 5 years in various prisons before he became the first democratically elected president of the Maldives. The old thugocracy that ran the country for 30 years has reasserted its control. The trial of Nasheed was a joke. He was not allowed witnesses. He was not allowed to prepare for the trial, which was held in secret. Two of the three judges deciding on the case were also witnesses in it. You know, it's Kafka come to the Indian Ocean. There's a strong, powerful resistance movement in the Maldives. I have no doubt that the capital city of Malé is filled with people who are trying to overturn this injustice. I also have no doubt that the very desperate regime will continue brutalizing people, and it's a great sadness. They have enough trouble in the Maldives dealing with the onset of climate change that they don't need this sort of thing. But our hopes are very much with President Nasheed. There are lots of people organizing to try and bring world attention, because the thing that the Maldives, you know, that the thugs who are running the country now thrive on is the fact that it's a small country a long ways away from everywhere, and we don't generally pay much attention. But
Bill, when he was deposed in a coup, I believe the U.S. was the first, if not one of the first countries, to recognize the new leadership.
You know, the U.S. does not have a particularly proud history in that part of the world. Let's hope that they change their mind. It's been good to see there's been some international pressure on the government to at least try to live up to international norms. But since they're not doing it, it's going to take more of a response. Nasheed really is a hero and a great man. And it's a shame to see what's happening there. And we'll continue to work on it just as hard as we can, because he is definitely one of our brothers in this climate fight.
Bill McKibben, finally, as you're there, holed up or comfy in your home in Vermont, you mentioned Boston, that has also hit an all-time record, the amount of snowfall that has hit Massachusetts. Can you finally end by talking about what's happening in the Northeast and the path to Paris, if you think what's going to happen in Paris is important, the next UN climate summit?
In the Northeast, the United States, we've seen over the last 50 years a 71% increase in the number of severe precipitation events, as the scientists put it. Way more big rainstorms and way more big snowfalls. When it happens in the summer, like it did in Vermont in 2011 with Hurricane Irene, we get so much rain that things wash away. When it happens in the winter, as it is in Boston this time, we get snowbanks five stories high. This provides yet more impetus as we continue this climate fight. I don't think that Paris in December, the next big negotiations, is the absolute key. I think what happens in Paris will depend on what kind of organizing we do before that, how much we stand up to the real powers that be, which are the Shells and the Exxons and the fossil fuel industry. They're the guys who are playing the politicians, not the other way around. And so this fight around divestment, around things like Keystone, putting ourselves in the way of every new fossil fuel expansion, what we've been calling a fossil freeze, is absolutely crucial. It's hopeful because that fossil freeze comes at a moment when we're also seeing a solar thaw, Amy. The price of solar panels is dropping so fast that their spread is now, the amount of solar power in the U.S. doubled last year. We could do this if we can break the power of this industry, if we can throw off its dead weight, then the world actually has a fighting chance, not of stopping global warming. It's, as Vanuatu illustrates, too late for that, but of keeping it from getting entirely out of control. It is the greatest fight we've ever been in. And though we don't know how it's going to come out, we know that we're all needed to make a real, real part in that battle.
Well, a final note, Boston's made history by having the snowiest and probably most miserable season since 1872. I'm reading from AP. The final 2.9 inches came after a record-setting monthly snowfall of 64.9 inches in February, well over 5 feet. The worst previous single month was January 2005, when 43.3 inches fell, so it's a third more than the worst previous single month. Bill McKibben, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of 350.org, author of a number of books, including Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. To see all our climate coverage, from the Pope to Peru, the last UN summit, go to democracynow.org. When we come back, we learn about the case of Julian Assange. He's been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 1,000 days. We'll talk about the new Swedish decision. Stay with us. Ecuador by Pierre Esteve, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today marks the 1,000th day that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has spent in Ecuador's London embassy, where he has political asylum. Now, for the first time, Swedish prosecutors have issued a request to question Assange in London. This follows pressure from their own courts, from Swedish courts, and repeated requests by Assange's lawyers. Assange has never been charged over allegations of sexual assault, yet he has been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London since 2012, fearing that if he steps outside, he would be arrested and extradited to Sweden, which could lead to his extradition to the United States. His lawyers have been asking Swedish prosecutors to question him in London for over 4 years. On Friday, Assange's attorney in Stockholm, Sweden, Per Samuelsson, welcomed the news.
The bottom line is, after the autumn of 2010, the prosecutor did nothing for more than 4 years. That's clear breach of Swedish law. That has hurt Mr. Assange severely, and that has also hurt both the women, who has not had their case tried for over 4 years, and it hurts the court, because witnesses forget, time passes on, and all the evidence is much worse now than it was back in 2010.
In July, Democracy Now! Went to London, to the Ecuadorian embassy, to speak with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange about the Swedish government's handling of his case.
There has been no movement, although the Swedish government is obligated to somehow progress the situation. They've been very happy to keep it in a complete stasis. They've refused to come here, to speak to me here or pick up a telephone or to accept an affidavit. They've also refused to provide a guarantee that I will not be extradited to the United States if I offered to go to Sweden. So that situation means we have to tackle the Swedish matter, it seems, in Sweden. The only other alternative is perhaps going to the International Court of Justice in relation to the asylum. The Swedish government has an obligation under its own law to proceed with maximum speed, with minimum cost, and also with bringing the minimum suspicion on the person who's been investigated. And it is in clear violation of all those points of law.
That was WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange speaking to Democracy Now! In July from inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. To see the whole hour, you can go to democracynow.org. But right now, we're joined by Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He and CCR are the U.S. attorneys for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. He's also the chairman of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. Michael, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of what the Swedish government has now said.
Well, it's the Swedish prosecutor, really, as you pointed out, being forced to do so because Julian's lawyers have gone to the Swedish courts and said, how can this go for 4 years with allegations? Over 4 years, Julian's in custody because he can't leave that embassy without being forced to go to Sweden and ultimately to the United States. But it's a victory for Julian, but it also shows the outrage of the Swedish prosecutor and their system. Here, it's 4 years. Julian has had to give up his passport, take refuge in the embassy, been given asylum, deprived of any kind of real freedom, no ability to visit his family, etc. 4 years later, now the prosecutor says, I can question Julian about these allegations.
So I want to go exactly to what she said. On Friday, the director of public prosecutions in Sweden, Marianne Nye, issued a statement. She wrote, quote, my view has always been that to perform an interview with him at the Ecuadorian embassy in London would lower the quality of the interview and that he would need to be present in Sweden in any case should there be a trial in the future. Now that time is of the essence. I have viewed it therefore necessary to accept such deficiencies in the investigation and likewise take the risk that the interview does not move the case forward.
Yeah, well, she's not telling the truth there. The Swedish Supreme Court just issued an order to the prosecutor saying, explain the investigatory delay in this case. The lower court said to her, this case has not proceeded according to Swedish law. So it's not right. She could have done this questioning a long time ago. Of course, one of the big problems with this is that, meanwhile, the U.S. has continued its intensive investigation of Julian Assange. Just a few weeks ago, they admitted that they were going forward with an espionage investigation.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, there was a court decision based in a Freedom of Information Act case in which documents were requested about WikiLeaks supporters and what the Department of Justice was doing with them and what the FBI was doing with them. And the court decision said, we can't turn over these documents because there's an ongoing multi-subject investigation of Julian Assange, and it's for espionage, conspiracy, theft of government documents. We know it from that, and we know it from search warrants that have been issued to three WikiLeaks employees that indicate that there's an ongoing investigation.
How can Julian Assange, who is not a U.S. citizen, be charged with espionage here?
Well, I always found that when I first got involved with this case, I always found that to be remarkable. He doesn't owe any loyalty to the United States as a citizen.
Is espionage different from the espionage law, the act?
Espionage is similar. Now, I think that one of the reasons you see that they're looking at him for theft of documents as well as for Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is because the U.S. understands that most countries in the world will not extradite Julian Assange for espionage. So they throw in these other, quote, non-espionage charges, even though they're all related to espionage. That's why they do it. Espionage is the classic political crime.
Explain what the Swedish prosecutor will be questioning Julian Assange about. Now, again, although some of the media will say he's been charged with sexual misconduct, he's never been charged. He hasn't even been questioned until apparently now he will be.
Right. Now, well, he did answer questions at one point in Sweden when he was there. And after that questioning, the charges were actually dismissed or not allowed to go forward. And then the case switched to another prosecutor, and that prosecutor then took it forward. So Sweden has this claimed, you know, authority that it has this wonderful, fair country, but in fact, it's not. And there was actually a recent periodic review of Sweden's compliance with its fundamental law and its laws of justice, and many countries have come in and said, what is going on in Sweden? How can it be 4 years for this? Well, as you said, it's allegations. He'll be questioned about those allegations. I'm assuming that the prosecutor will go forward and do this. Of course, there are some conditions. She has to apply under the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, which I assume Ecuador and the U.K. Will allow it. She also has to turn over her investigative file to Julian Assange's lawyers and the defense team.
To you.
The defense team in Sweden, yes. And that is one of the things that has been litigated in the courts. How come they have failed to turn over parts of the file to Julian Assange's lawyers? And that ultimately, this case and what's going to happen to it is going to go to the European Court of Human Rights on a number of issues, including his arbitrary detention in the embassy. But in the end, Sweden is there. But in the final answer is it's what's happened in the United States and the fact that this ongoing multi-subject investigation of Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, publishers, let's repeat that, publishers of documents taken by others.
What does espionage charges in the United States have to do with sexual misconduct allegations in Sweden?
Well, the main thing is that Julian would have gone to Sweden a long time ago had he gotten a guarantee from Sweden that they will not forward him to the United States for standing trial on the espionage charges. Sweden has never been willing to give that guarantee, and Sweden has a very bad reputation of complying with U.S. demands, whether it was sending some people from Sweden to Egypt for torture, or whether it's guaranteeing people who are asylees in Sweden that they won't be deported. So Sweden has not—a key here is that Sweden has not given the guarantee that it's required to do and to recognize Julian's asylum. Let's understand, he's been given asylum by Ecuador. Every country in the world is obligated to recognize that asylum. And that's asylum because Ecuador said Julian Assange will be persecuted in the United States.
We only have a minute. What can happen now? Well, first of all, do you think part of the change has to do with the Swedish government changing?
I don't know that. I know that there's been heavy litigation in Sweden by Julian's lawyers, and the courts, as I said, have slapped that prosecutor around.
So what can happen now? A Swedish prosecutor goes to London. Ecuador has hailed this decision. Of course, will allow the questioners to go into the embassy. They will question Julian Assange, and what happens from that?
Well, there's different consequences that could happen. One is they could say that, as the first prosecutor said, that this case isn't strong enough to go forward with that case. That would be one. A second thing they could say is, well, maybe they could say, well, we think we're going to go forward anyway. But let's bring out one fact. Julian has now spent over 4 years in custody of some form. As you said, he opened 1,000 days in the embassy, almost 3 years. If he were sentenced, if he were convicted of these allegations, they were made into charges, and he's convicted, he would not do He's done all the time he would have to do. And therefore, he wouldn't do any time any longer. So the whole case is essentially a bogus way of keeping him in that embassy, and he has to be kept out of the United States and recognized asylum.
Michael Ratner, attorney for Julian Assange, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. To see all of our coverage of the Julian Assange case and our interview with him in the Ecuadorian embassy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Amato Nirmin Sheikh, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.